Which God do we worship? Do we worship the God of life or the God of death? Does God promise abundance or scarcity? In which economy do we put our faith? These might not seem like obvious questions in response to the conflict between Joseph and his brothers, but they go to the heart of tonight's story. Let's remember. Yet again we have a story of favouritism. A parent prefers a younger son and spoils him. For Jacob preferred Joseph and gave him a special coat. Meanwhile, Joseph dreams that his family bows down to him. And this was also hurtful, that his brothers couldn't speak a civil word to Joseph, and they hated him. They first plot to kill him, and then they decide to sell him into slavery. Why did his brothers react like this? The answer is rooted in economics. In the world of ancient Israel, and in some societies today, good is considered to be fixed and scarce and finite. In other words, there's only a certain amount of wealth and power. This wealth and power doesn't grow, and it's already distributed. And so if someone becomes wealthy and powerful, it means that other people must lose whatever power and wealth that they have. Now Joseph is the youngest brother. He's the bottom of the ladder. He cannot stand above his brothers in this worldview unless every single one of them is stripped of their status. And so Joseph's dreams seem to predict his brothers' humiliation and ruin. No wonder they decide to destroy the dreamer and remove the threat of disaster. They throw him down a dry well, then sit down to eat together, united by the elimination of the insufferable little tattletale from their midst. And then, of course, Joseph is fished up, sold to Ishmaelite traders, and sent down to Egypt as a slave. You see, the brothers just could not imagine that an increase in Joseph's status could mean good things for them. But that's exactly what happened. In Egypt, as he was an adept interpreter of dreams, Joseph became Pharaoh's trusted advisor and the second in command of the whole country. During years of plenty, he stockpiled crops. During years of famine, he doled them out. His work ensured the survival of both Egypt and Israel, for during the famine his family sought help and he provided for them. In other words, the dreams that his brothers heard as oppressive turn out to be good news. Joseph's rise in status does not diminish their status. In fact, it ensures their very survival. To people who believe that the world contains limited good, Joseph's story is radical. It suggests that good can increase. And if God is at the wheel, as Joseph witnesses in Egypt, then God must be the source of infinite good, a well that will never run dry. God's economy is abundant indeed. However, we 21st century Westerners need to be careful about how we understand this. Unlike Joseph's family, we live in an economy based not on limited good, but on limitless growth. This sounds like an economy of abundance, but it's not the same. God's economy gathers up surplus and redistributes it to those in need. When Jesus picnics on the hillside with his followers, there are 12 baskets left over, enough for the 12 tribes of Israel. And again, in a later story, there are 7 baskets left over, enough for the 7 days of creation. There's always enough in God's economy, but it's redistributed to those who need it. A human economy, however, gathers up the surplus and uses it for gain. And this human way of doing things is so insidious that even Joseph sells out. Although his work in Egypt saves nations from starvation, in Genesis 47 we learn that the years in the imperial household have changed him. The famine is enduring. And Joseph first takes all the people's money, then all their livestock, then all their land, and then their freedom in return for grain. His actions feed the people, but they also gradually turn Egypt into an absolute monopoly. Pharaoh comes to own everything and everyone. All the people are enslaved. As Walter Brueggemann writes, Joseph was not a bad man, not especially coerced, more likely seduced. But his capitulation to imperial economics leads to great suffering and oppression. In the same way, our capitulation to an economy of limitless growth, the economy we live in, leads to great suffering and oppression too. Whether it's people or animals or land, they all suffer by our rapacious materialism. And it is also leading to our spiritual death. For we Australians are producing astronomical levels of waste. We are levelling vast tracts of rainforest. We are gouging out minerals from sacred ground. We are destroying the Great Barrier Reef for coal. We are pouring carbon into our atmosphere, and we're filling our oceans with plastic. And meanwhile, we're reporting staggering rates of loneliness and isolation and depression. This is hardly God's vision of health and wholeness and abundance. So for those of us who are rich, that is everyone in this room and everyone who reads this, participating in God's economy of abundance almost certainly means, paradoxically, giving things up. Giving up wealth, giving up status, giving up possessions, convenience, habits, giving up these things so that others might have enough. Because in God's economy, nothing is stockpiled for gain. Jacob and his sons, they struggle to understand God's economy. Jacob's love for Joseph should have deepened his love for everyone, but it didn't. It led to a corrosive favoritism. Joseph's brothers could have delighted in Joseph's blessings and trusted it would lead to blessings for them. But instead they let envy consume them, and they conspired to destroy their brother. And Joseph himself gave up on God's economy as he moved from saving the people to consolidating and extending Pharaoh's imperial power. Like Jacob and Joseph and all the rest, we too struggle against God's economy as we live in the economy that we do. And every day we make choices about which economy we live in. Every time we take more than we need. Every time we buy too much. Every time we throw good things away. We embody the dominant economy, the economy of human power. As long as we hoard and waste and destroy, other people lose out, and it will be to our enduring shame. For an economy of abundance, God's economy, does not mean an economy of greed or an economy of waste. Instead, it's an economy of enough. Enough food, enough clothes, enough housing, enough healthcare, enough education for you and for me and for everyone else too. Embodying God's economy means learning to critique the economy we live in and making different choices. It takes creativity and cooperation and courage. But we are here because we're drawn to it, this culture which leads to real life. For in God's economy, we don't need to worry about where we'll live or what we'll eat or drink or wear, for God will take care of everything. In God's economy, we're no longer driven by envy, and we don't have to fear the envy of others, for we will know life's great abundance and God's deep and abiding love. In God's economy, 5 loaves and 2 fish feed a whole hillside of people, as long as we are willing to share. to our independent and over-consuming selves, shaped by the economy we live in. A life like this, trusting God, may appear limiting. But as we learn to rely on God and other people, and to share what we have, we begin to experience true wealth, and our growth in faith and in love knows no bounds. For this economy is about life, more life, lived fully in the life of God. To life lived joyfully and generously and freely. And it's an economy which benefits everyone. Amen.